I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to a conversation with the investigators on the medical oncology aspects of the management of urothelial bladder cancer. We have Dr. Petros Grivas from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, Dr. Dan Petrylak from the Yale School of Medicine, and Dr. Arlene Siefker-Radke from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. If you're into audio programs, and we know lots of people end up listening to replays of these webinars, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program with Dr. Matthew Galsky on the management of urothelial bladder cancer. This program is part of our post-ASCO series. Today, we're here to talk about bladder cancer, so many amazing and exciting things that have gone on in the last couple of years, so many questions that people have. I met with each one of our faculty separately over the last few weeks and recorded their presentation that goes through the data, the slides, presents cases. Here's where we're heading. We're going to initially talk about metastatic disease, particularly sequencing of therapy. We'll talk about antibody-drug conjugates, which Dan covered in his talk, and FGF-targeted therapy, which Arlene covered in her talk. And then we'll finish out talking about checkpoint inhibitors, everywhere from the non-muscle invasive to the metastatic setting as well. We actually sent out a survey to the attendees of this conference, and we're going to show you the results of that. But first, we're going to do something we have never done before. And we're just going to quickly play Oncology Family Feud with the faculty. So faculty, one of the things that we asked the attendees, we got almost 100 responses from people attending this conference over the last day or so, was what questions should we ask you? What questions do we ask the faculty? And so I want you to guess which was the most common question that they have. And I will tell you that there were five times as many people asking this question as the next question. It was clearly the most important question. You can see everything that's there. Arlene, I was sort of teasing you to see if you could guess it. What do you think the number one question was, Arlene?
Looking at the questions, I mean, there's so many good questions you ask. Adjuvant immunotherapy, which is a really hot topic, combining immunotherapy with enfortumab, looking at sequencing, you know, are we going to see distinct biology? I think it could be any one of the three.
You think it could be any one. So Dan, what do you think? Yeah. What are you hearing from oncologists when you go out and give CME lectures? What's the most common question they ask you?
Can you use immune therapy as neoadjuvant therapy? That's one. Mm. Another would be the role of combining enfortumab with immune therapy because the results are so striking in the phase one, phase two trial. And then should I use, in a PD-L1 positive patient, should I use immune therapy, then chemo, or chemo and then maintenance immune therapy? I think those are the three questions I hear the most.
So Petros, imagine, you know, this conference, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, you know, we didn't have anything to talk about. Now we've got tons of stuff. And so far, the first two faculty have not hit on the number one question. So you've got one chance to do it, Petros. What do you think the number one question is from oncologists about bladder cancer?
Because of the dynamic landscape and the changes going on, I would probably vote for the optimal sequencing of therapies, the sequence of therapies, because it's such a big question that people ask me all the time.
So there you go. You get your $100 to Petros. So here's the way it was. Number three, this has surprised me, and you'll see some data about this that surprised me as well. Immunotherapy for non-muscle invasive was number three. Number two, I think Dan mentioned this. I was surprised how many people asked about combining enfortumab with immunotherapy. But as Petros suggested, number one, by far, they want to know how to sequence. Can you imagine, Arlene, again, 3 or 4 years ago, what's the optimal third-line therapy, the fourth-line therapy of bladder cancer? Mm-hmm. And that's where we are. So we actually changed the agenda a little bit once we saw these questions. And we're going to go through some of the questions that they actually asked when we get to these specific section. I thought this one's kind of interesting. At the bottom there, Dan, and we'll get into IOs, but you know, it gets into, someone says, why does it seem that the general urologist is not aware of data regarding IO agents with recurrent non-muscle invasive disease? Dan, of course, we have lots of, you know, oncology urologists, but as this person suggests, they're general urologists. How much of a need do you think there is, Dan, to be informing them about these new data, particularly with checkpoint inhibitors, non-muscle invasive disease?
Well, I think the need is clearly there for two reasons. Number one, the traditional approach to carcinoma in situ is giving intravesical therapy with BCG, BCG interferon, and then salvage therapies such as gemcitabine combined with a taxane. And there are newer trials that are looking at some other immune agents in that situation given intravesically. So traditionally, we've not given checkpoint or systemic therapy for those patients with non-muscle invasive disease. And so because it's such a shift in how you take care of the patients, I think the urologists really do need to know about it. And they're not familiar with systemic therapy in that situation.
So Arlene, here's some other questions that we got. We kind of grouped these together. We're just going to hit on a couple of ones that we're not going to cover later. We saw some stuff at ASCO, Arlene, about cystectomy sparing strategies, a couple of new papers. And there were a number of questions that people had about that. Also, this question here, what chemo do you pair with radiation therapy? Any thoughts about these issues, Arlene?
Oh, these are great questions. And it really builds on what we've seen with immune checkpoint inhibitors and metastatic disease, with several investigators, including myself, reporting patients who are now 7 years out from their incurable cancer, having stable, partial, and even complete remissions. So if we can achieve this in metastatic disease, can we now achieve it in non-muscle and muscle-invasive bladder cancer and spare people from their cystectomies? The challenge is selecting the right patient for the right treatment. And we've seen a combination of chemo strategies using chemo to select responders where they're given options of whether to preserve the bladder or have the cystectomy, use of immunotherapy with radiation. So I think this field is going to evolve over time and it will rely on a combination of patient selection, finding the right fit for the right patient, but also finding a treatment that has that durable activity and doesn't place the patient at substantial risk of dying from their cancer.
So one more question here. Petros, this is, we could add five slides just on this topic. There are so many questions put in different ways. I like the person who does all caps and says, you know, which agent do I use first? What's third line? What's fourth line? What's fifth line? But I want to ask you about this, Petros, at the bottom there you see, do all these data apply to upper tract transitional cell cancer? Another question, any data for squamous cell urothelial bladder cancer?
Thanks, Neil. These are great questions. So we can go through the sequencing data in our talks. But the simple answer for the practicing oncologist is, if you have metastatic disease, we treat the same way, even if it came from the lower tract bladder, which is the most common location of urothelial cancer, or the upper tract disease. When it comes to the localized disease setting, we're now trying to do some dedicated upper urinary tract trials, like neoadjuvant or adjuvant trials, which you know many of them are evolving. But for metastatic disease, I would probably treat it the same way. Regarding variant histologies, it's a great question, and Arlene has done a lot of work with that area. It depends on if we talk about a mixed urothelial carcinoma with squamous cell features. In that case, I would treat it the same way with pure urothelial cancer. If it's a pure squamous cell, it's a different story, probably different biology. And I would pick more like a maybe carbotaxol, carbogem kind of a squamous cell carcinoma targeting a regimen. I would extrapolate for squamous cell carcinoma data from other tumor types.
So let's talk about sequencing of therapy again, particularly third line and beyond. This is a slide that Petros had in his talk, sort of painting a picture of kind of where we might end up seeing these patients as they sort of enter the oncology system. We're not going to try to cover everything here. We're really going to try to get into clinical nitty gritty, particularly again, this complexity of metastatic disease. Let's talk, begin talking about antibody drug conjugates. And you know, Dan, we did a program on prostate cancer, as a matter of fact. And one of the questions we said was to the audience in that survey was, have you ever given a PARP inhibitor to a prostate cancer patient? And they saw plenty of patients. And actually, 40% of the audience had never used a PARP inhibitor. And yet, here they were in a conference. One of the things we were covering, we spent half the time, was on PARP inhibitors. And we look here also as well. When we said to our audience, have you used enfortumab and metastatic urothelial bladder cancer. Half of the audience has not used it. And I was thinking about, you know, when you have a football team and they practice a special play that they're only going to use at the end of the game. And every time they practice it, but they only use it once or twice in a season. But when they use it, they better know how to use it. And I think that's the way oncology is. You know, you need to get it right the first time. And that's really why we're here today. We look at sacituzumab, of course, recently approved. Next time we should ask them, have they used it in breast cancer? I'll bet you a lot of we've been hearing a lot about sacituzumab and breast cancer, particularly triple negative disease. But in bladder, again, only 20% of the audience at this point has used it. Not very hard to figure out. All right, well, let's go through a few scenarios because we really want to get into this question again of sequencing and then particularly where antibody drug conjugates come in. And then we'll start to bring in erdafitinib. So Arlene, here's a clinical case scenario. There's a patient who has a recurrence in the liver after cystectomy and adjuvant chemotherapy. We're saying it's FGR wild type. So the question is, what's going to be next? And I thought it was kind of interesting here, Arlene, that I would have expected it to be a checkpoint inhibitor. And yet a significant fraction of the audience says enfortumab. Any thoughts, mm-hmm. Arlene?
So when you look at the indication for immune checkpoint inhibitors, it does include treatment within 12 months of the last dose of neoadjuvant or adjuvant chemotherapy, since clinical outcomes are similar to second-line metastatic patients. Now, the challenge in this particular case is the liver metastases, and liver metastases historically have had very poor responses to the immune checkpoint inhibitor, with some trials suggesting it's much less than 10%. When we see liver mets, it's a poor prognosis and cytoreduction is key. So I would typically pick a more cytoreductive therapy as well. And I would be inclined to treat with enfortumab vedotin in that clinical scenario.
So here's another question. Dan, maybe you can comment on this. We said you have an elderly patient. I'm not sure that makes a difference with these drugs, but anyhow, you have an elderly patient. Again, we're sticking with FGR wild type before you kind of make it more complicated in a few minutes. Patient is elderly and doesn't get chemo, not platinum eligible, gets started on pembrolizumab, and now has disease progression, including a disease in the liver. And the audience favors enfortumab over sacituzumab. Dan, again, any thoughts about this scenario?
Well, the FDA just recently approved enfortumab for that particular indication, a patient who has progressed after a checkpoint inhibitor, who is, by the sounds of it, this is a frail patient who's not eligible to receive cisplatin chemotherapy. So that's where the indication is. I think enfortumab would be a good choice in this situation based upon the response rate in liver. It's 40% in all studies that have been performed, phase 1, phase 2, phase 3. Sacituzumab is not yet approved for that indication. There are trials that are evaluating that in the platinum ineligible checkpoint experienced patient. So perhaps we'll see in the future an approval, but right now enfortumab is FDA approved for that indication.
So Hassan in the chat room asked the question, and actually both Arlene and Petrus responded. Hassan says, how do you treat adenocarcinoma with mucinous features, metastatic disease? How do you think that went through, Petrus?
So ideally, we need clinical trials in this setting, and Arlene has done a very nice trial, and she posted the regimen there. Arlene, you can talk more about it. It's combination of 5-FU, gemcitabine, and leucovorin, and cisplatin for urothelial adenocarcinomas. And in clinical practice, that's something to consider. Other regimens options are colorectal cancer kind of regimens like FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, which I have used in clinical practice with variable responses. So I treat this pure adenocarcinoma based on extrapolation from the colorectal cancer types. I definitely would consider next generation sequencing to look for potential treatment targets. And there is a clinical trial I want to point out. It's called ICONIC, I-C-O-N-I-C. Dr. Apollo is the PI and actually looks at a rare urinary tract cancer variant. So that may be a good fit for that patient.
So here's another question that we asked the audience, I was kind of surprised by the answer. I'm curious, Dan, what you think about this. One of the most common questions we got was related to using enfortumab plus an IO. If you look through the slides, you can read some of the questions. One of the questions we got was, quote, the data with enfortumab with pembro, even though it's a small study, is very impressive. Do they anticipate it will become standard of care in the future, considering traditional risk factors for bladder cancer are less common, like smoking, chemicals? And also they throw in the question of why is the incidence rising? So Dan, let's first start out with the fact that somehow the audience, a third of them have actually done this outside a trial setting. What do you think about that, Dan? And any thoughts about, I guess there's a lot of excitement about this, but is this ready to be tried out outside a trial setting in your opinion, Dan?
Well, I think we need more data from the trial setting before this can be used. However, the data is quite exciting. We do see response rates. It's fairly high. But again, these are small numbers of patients. So there is a randomized trial that is going on as part of the EV-103 trial of enfortumab versus enfortumab combined with pembro for first-line therapy in platinum-ineligible patients. And that could lead to the accelerated approval of the combination. So I think the data is exciting. I don't think it's quite ready yet to be used in prime time because of the small numbers, but we await the completion of the randomized study.
Petrus, you went through some of the data. I think people have seen this kind of schematic and are pretty familiar with antibody drug conjugates. I feel like we're talking about that in almost every cancer type, everything from cancer of the cervix to multiple myeloma, you name it, so many antibody drug conjugates out there. But the response of this agent seems to be pretty substantial. Petrus, I'm curious what your clinical experience has been, both in terms of efficacy and what kind of tolerability issues you run into.
Thanks, Neil. So I just a quick comment on the previous question. I totally agree with Dan regarding EV-Pembro combination. The data looked very promising when we saw the data initially. It captured the attention. I think it was ESMO a couple of years ago, but we need more data. We need a larger number of patients. And in that context, there are two trials we're waiting. The one is the EV-302, which is the randomized phase 3 trial, pembro EV versus chemo. There's no maintenance in the chemo in that trial. And the EV-103, which you are showing the slide now, which has a randomized cohort of pembro plus EV versus EV alone. We'll have to see what that trial shows before I adopt this combo in clinical practice. So the short answer is no, but I'm waiting. I'm very excited about it. The EV alone data in my practice is consistent with the clinical trial data. EV-201 and EV-301. I think it's interesting to see this rapid clinical improvement of patients on enfortumab alone, which I think is important for the quality of life standpoint. And this usually is corroborated by radiological improvement. Toxicity, I think Dr. Sifkarat did a great job at a prior ASCO GU meeting discussing some important toxicities. Fatigue, anorexia is something that we see commonly. And I think the three highlighted items that Dan also had highlighted before is peripheral neuropathy, especially in the population of senior patients with prior platinum, maybe diabetic, skin rash, which is usually mild to moderate. The topical steroids usually do the trick, but sometimes rarely you can see Steven Johnson. There's a black box warning now about it. So keep an eye on that. And also about 5% of patients, 1 out of 20 patients, they get this strange hyperglycemia that can be life-threatening. So keep an eye on CMP on those patients, glucose, and there is some anecdotal correlation with higher BMI. So extra attention to hyperglycemia, skin rash, neuropathy, fatigue, anorexia, alopecia as well. Very consistent with the clinical trial data.
So Dan, anything you want to add to that, particularly what you see in the first couple of weeks of starting enfortumab, and how do you begin when you're starting enfortumab to follow them? How often do you get glucoses? Can you talk a little bit about your experience with that, Dan?
So one of the impressive things we've found with enfortumab, especially in a patient who has bone metastases, is relief of pain. And I've often remarked to the staff that we work with, my nurse practitioners and the data managers, that you can tell if somebody's responding almost immediately if they have symptomatic bone pain relief and they've got documented bone metastases. So the responses with enfortumab are rapid. We've seen that from the data where the median time to response is 1.9 months. Also, we do monitor their neurological function regularly. We monitor their glucose on a daily basis. We also empower shared care with primary care doctors to be sure that if a patient is diabetic to begin with, that they have the proper diabetic care. That's sort of out of my range right now. And I really want a specialist to help me with that particular issue. So those are the things we look for, particularly with the neuropathy. My feeling is hold doses early or dose reduce early, because the long-term goal here is getting as much drug as over time as possible.
So again, I see in the chat room, and audience, forgive us for jumping around, but that's just the way we do stuff. You know, it's like rounds, whatever pops into our head, we do. It's all good. So Eric jumps on another topic that I see again, both Arlene and Petrus respond to. So Arlene, you know, pretty classic question at this point after the last year and a half. Are you all giving, here's the question of Eric, are all of you investigators giving maintenance immunotherapy after chemo in the first line setting? And I'll ask also, which specific are you giving avelumab? Petros says, I do if there's no progression on platinum-based chemo, no contraindication to avelumab. Arlene, how do you deal with that question, whether you're going to use maintenance or maybe hold off and treat on progression?
Well, I think we do have two good standards. So I view it as a win-win situation. I think patients who have a more of a partial response where there's disease, especially in visceral metastases, they probably need the maintenance avelumab to keep them in that better response. But there are patients who are in CR, and Petros presented that data at ESMO, suggesting patients who are in a CR may not have as much benefit from maintenance avelumab. So I think it's worth a discussion with the patients, especially during the time of a pandemic, when coming in at every 2 week intervals can be concerning depending upon coronavirus levels.
So Arlene, how about using Pembro and have them come in every 6 weeks?
Well, that's an interesting thought. If we look at the second line data, we originally had multiple 5 agents approved, including avelumab, pembro, atezo, nivo, and durva. So we had multiple approvals. But when we look at where we found level one evidence, it was with maintenance or with second line pembro. Now, could there be differences between avelumab and pembro? There certainly could be. Avelumab reports some antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity. So perhaps in the maintenance setting, avelumab does have a preference compared to pembro. There was a trial from Matt Galsky, which asked that question, whether giving maintenance pembro versus pembro at progression had an impact on outcomes. And there was a similar survival. So you could argue, is it just luck of the trial? One trial was positive, one was negative, or the fact that the avelumab trial included places where patients may not receive second-line immunotherapy? Or is there a difference between avelumab and pembrolizumab? I would argue I don't yet know that answer.
So Dan, let's talk a little bit about the other antibody drug conjugates that's available. And again, I can only imagine whether you would imagine that a couple of years ago, you have 2 antibody drug conjugates to choose from. What do we know about sacituzumab govitecan, Dan? How does SASI work, Dan? And what do we know about in bladder cancer?
So sacituzumab is a ADC. It recognizes TROP2, which is an epithelial antigen that's present in a number of different tumors. It's already approved in breast cancer. It's also present in pancreatic as well as in ovarian cancer. It delivers a different payload than enfortumab. Enfortumab delivers MMAE, methylmonorotastatin, which is an antitubulin. This is a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor, SN38, and the linker technology is different than it is with enfortumab. It's a different linker. It's hydrolyzable, and it has a high drug antibody to payload ratio of 7.6 to 1. So it's a different molecule, delivers a different drug, recognizes a different epitope.
So what about the activity, Dan? You know, again, in breast cancer, we did a conference, and Hope Rugo was saying that almost all these patients with breast respond. A lot of excitement in breast, particularly as it's so well tolerated. What do we know about its activity in urothelial bladder cancer, Dan?
Well, we know from the TROPHY-01 study that the response rate's about 27% and the confidence limits are between 20 and 36%. These are unselected patients, but I think it's important to know also that 31% of patients who have disease in liver have an objective response. So it does have activity. It perhaps maybe a different activity than we see with enfortumab, but it's difficult to compare these phase two studies to each other.
So my trusty people checked the survey, and we actually did ask them if they used sacituzumab in breast cancer, and actually almost half of the people in the audience have used it in breast cancer. So even though they haven't used it in bladder cancer yet, a lot of people have already used it in breast cancer, Dan. Here's some other efficacy data. But what about AEs, Dan? What do we know, and what's your experience with it?
Well, it's a different pattern of AEs. The predominant AEs with sacituzumab include neutropenia as well as diarrhea. Pretty much everybody that I treat with sacituzumab receives G-CSF prophylactically. And I generally would like give that after day eight, maybe a 14-day course. But generally, they do need some form of growth factor support. The diarrhea can be controlled with Imodium, loperamide, other agents as well. So I think that there are ways of controlling it. The drug is fairly well tolerated, and it's, again, a different side effect pattern.
So, Arlene, you know, there's data and then there's experience. And I like the experience part just as well as the data. So particularly because a lot of the audience, only 20% has even used it in urothelial bladder cancer. Can you relate what your experience has been, both in terms of efficacy and tolerability, Arlene?
So it definitely has efficacy. It has cytoreduction. It helps with pain control. You see responses early. And what I like is it is a different toxicity profile compared to enfortumab. You know, enfortumab does have the peripheral neuropathy, which can be dose limiting, where patients have to discontinue therapy because of it. And giving sacituzumab provides a good alternative, or even, I think, considering it in patients who have pre-existing neuropathy and wish to avoid any worsening of that neuropathy.
I was going to ask that. Petros, very common to see patients with, as Arlene was saying, pre-existing neuropathy, diabetes, et cetera. How do you think through your choices in that situation? And again, I'm curious what your experiences with AEs with sacituzumab, Petros.
I agree with what Dan and Arlene mentioned. So when I think about the patient decision choice, I go by the level of evidence, efficacy, toxicity profile, and patient comorbidities. I would say that enfortumab has level one evidence now based on the V301 trial, and it's probably the agent that probably most people will use first. However, I can envision patient populations where someone could consider using sacituzumab first, and these are patients with severe neuropathy, for example, grade two or higher, as Arlene alluded to, because neuropathy can be tricky. It is hard to treat. So you have another agent, you can consider it, especially if it's FDA approved, like sacituzumab or erdafitinib in some patients. The other population, which is a question, is patients with uncontrolled diabetes, hemoglobin A1C more than 8, or very obese patients. You know, it begs the question, right? Is this patient's population a reasonable try sacituzumab before enfortumab? I think these are open questions. I don't think we have the right answer, but a reasonable considerations in addition to the level of evidence, efficacy, and toxicity profiles, and patient comorbidities. In terms of your second question about toxicity, it's very consistent with what we published at JCO with a sacituzumab TROPHY-01 trial. Neutropenia, as Dan mentioned, is, you know, a common phenomenon. Is usually managed, and Dan said that, with either dose reductions and or growth factor. And if you look at the rate of febrile neutropenia, it's about 10%. Again, usually you can manage this with dose reductions and growth factor or. Diarrhea is about 60% of the patients, and usually it's grade one, grade two. It seems to be around the time of administration of the drug. So the day one, day eight of the 21-day cycles, around that time, usually managed with anti-diarrhea medications, loperamide, diphenoxylate, hydration, electrolytes. Most patients are able to continue treatment, and some of them may require dose reduction. Fatigue, appetite issues can happen. The good thing is, as we discussed, this has much less neuropathy. And the other interesting thing is, good to have options for the patient. So if you have progression on enfortumab, you can potentially have a reasonable chance to respond to sacituzumab, because, and vice versa, because of a different mechanism of action. Different antibody target, different linker, and different chemotherapy payload.
Different tolerability issues too, because a lot less problems than chemotherapy, which is kind of what you're really delivering here. Let's finish out with a couple cases. And again, I really recommend you check out Dan's presentation. We go through these cases in much more detail. But just what I really want to focus on, Dan, you pick, this was a 67-year-old woman who had a pretty complicated history. She ended up getting ipi-nivo, but basically in 2016 got started in a phase 1 trial of enfortumab. What was her kind of condition at that point, Dan, and what happened when you started the enfortumab?
She was pretty ill. She was having nightly tumor fevers. She was losing, I think she lost about 10 or 15 pounds. And it was interesting that the first manifestation of her progression right after her cystectomy was a fever. She was feeling poorly after her nephrectomy, excuse me. And she was losing weight. She works as a real estate agent, was still trying to work at that particular time, and then went on enfortumab, and her symptoms improved almost immediately. And she's in a complete response, has been in a complete response since that time.
So, of course, you know, people naturally want to present patients who do well. And we're, I guess, not trying to say every patient's going to have a five-year response like this, but I think it is really interesting slash amazing that something like that could happen. And the question I always ask in that situation, Arlene, is why? Why is this patient different from the more typical patient who doesn't have a five-year response? Any thoughts about that, Arlene?
That is a great question. Is it somehow related to Nectin-4 expression or, you know, TROP2 expression if we start seeing this with SG? Is it somehow related to underlying biology, perhaps DNA repair defects where DNA damaging agents may have more of an impact? I would argue we really don't understand the biology associated with response to enfortumab vedotin, mostly because the company hasn't invested yet in those biologic studies, helping us understand which patients are more likely to respond.
Dan, that brings us to our other case I want to just briefly talk about, and got some images here as well. This 61-year-old man, and I think he actually ended up getting both enfortumab and sacituzumab. Anything about this case you want to comment on? Again, we went into a lot more detail with your presentation, but anything you want to comment on about the case?
Well, I think the important thing to note is that he responded to both. The patient received adjuvant gemcitabine after his cystectomy and then received atezolizumab for almost 2 years and then had an 8-month response to enfortumab. He was placed on pemetrexed after the enfortumab because we had nothing else to offer. And then we opened up the phase 2 trial of sacituzumab, and he went on that and responded, had great improvement. It had significant lower extremity edema, which improved pretty rapidly. So both of these agents are, you know, theoretically, they should be non-cross resistant. And we see responses in patients who've been on either drug. And so progression on one drug should not preclude the trying another drug for treatment.
So let's move on to our next topic as part of this issue of sequencing and metastatic disease. This is something that Arlene covered, and of course, has been a leader in the field. Only a quarter of the audience has actually used erdafitinib. And again, this whole issue of, you know, lung cancer, we're finding mutations that occur in, you know, 1% or less, and these docs have to be ready to know what to do about it. Same thing's happening all over oncology. So hopefully we can get you kind of into a better, into a good preparation state. So we have a 65-year-old patient who's got an FGFR3 mutation, but has disease recurrence in the liver after cystectomy and an adjuvant chemotherapy. So you would think typical second-line therapy would be an IO in this situation, Dan. The patient's got an FGFR mutation. They've got liver mets. Arlene's going to say that because they have FGFR, they've probably got a cold tumor, not going to respond to an IO anyhow. It sounds like the audience is thinking the same thing. Everybody wants to give erdafitinib, Dan. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think that that's a very reasonable way of going about it. One way to look at this is, you know, you've got the target present in the patient with FGFR3. Likely you have nectin as well, because 90% of urothelial specimens have nectin expression. The real question is how do you sequence these drugs? And my experience has been there's a lot of fatigue with erdafitinib. And it may be better to go with this up front. I mean, that's one way to look at this, because you have the target and you may be able to administer it, you know, more at full dose than you would if somebody has gone third line in this setting. There's no right or wrong answer to this. Enfortumab has a 40% response rate in liver. that's also in its favor. So I think you have to do what you're most comfortable with and which, I guess, line of logic you feel is the most valid.
I'm going to go back to Arlene. We asked the audience, we're kind of getting back to what Dan was just talking about. What do you start with? Assuming you have somebody who theoretically you could get all three. The audience says enfortumab. Dan was saying maybe you'd go to erdafitinib while they're in good condition. What do you think, Arlene?
So I do have a favor, or would favor the erdafitinib. Again, we don't have confirmatory data suggesting or confirming which is the best strategy of the sequence. There was an abstract presented looking at patients treated with enfortumab vedotin who had FGFR3 alterations. And again, small numbers of patients, so not definitive evidence, but it did suggest that those who received erdafitinib first did better when they received the enfortumab after the erdafitinib compared to enfortumab first. But I think we do need trials to confirm these types of findings. You can't really make a long-term judgment call based on retrospective evidence. I would favor in the setting of visceral metastases such as liver, the response rates with immunotherapy are low, and I would look for a cytoreducer. Erdafitinib has similar response rate in liver versus other visceral metastases and visceral versus nodal metastases. So with this 40% response rate across the board, where you also see that with enfortumab vedotin, I don't think anyone would argue if you would choose one over the other, although I will admit a bias toward the erdafitinib.
So I always love it when you go through the biology, Arlene, of these tumors and particularly the hot and cold nature of these. It's so fascinating. I mean, maybe you could just sort of capsulize your vision of how these, you know, why these tumors maybe don't respond as well. Then I'm going to curious to see what Petrus thinks about what you say. Mm-hmm. So can you kind of explain that, Arlene?
Sure. When you look at gene expression profiling data, what we saw is that there's different subtypes of bladder cancer, basal that has a lot of similarities with triple negative breast cancers. We see these luminal subtypes that have now been subdivided into luminal papillary or immune excluded tumors. And when you look where the FGFR3 alterations fall, they do tend to enrich for that luminal papillary or immune-excluded phenotypes. So is there something about the mutation that may help prevent the immune cells from getting to the tumor? Is it something about the immune response? Is it a lack of an interferon gamma gene signature, which sometimes occurs early as well in these patients? Could it be the fibroblasts providing some type of moat around the tumor, keeping immune cells from entering? I would argue we don't know fully what the causes are. But there has been retrospective data suggesting lower response rates or lower durations of response in the setting of FGFR3 alterations treated with immunotherapy. Conversely, there's data suggesting they may respond at a similar rate compared to non-FGF altered tumors. And that's why it's so important to conduct clinical trials. And the THOR clinical trial tests this question by comparing in patients who have no prior immunotherapy, erdafitinib versus pembrolizumab for the FGFR3 altered tumor. And then for patients who've already had immune checkpoint inhibition, they're randomized between erdafitinib and a taxane. So hopefully as these trials accrue, we will have the evidence to share to say whether it is better to sequence with erdafitinib before an immune checkpoint inhibitor or not.
So Petrus, any thoughts about this? And also I noticed that you answered a question in the chat room about whether you would ever in metastatic disease give a checkpoint inhibitor to somebody who already had it in the past, maybe they had avelumab maintenance. There was a question in there about ipi/nivo, which of course everybody asked about. So any thoughts about Arlene's thought about the cold nature of FGFR tumors, and what about repeating an IO maybe two or three lines later in metastatic disease, Petrus?
Sure. I think Arlene covered it extremely well. I agree with her answer. I think the biology is very interesting and keeps evolving this story. There is some data, as Arlene mentioned, that these tumors have less T-cell infiltrate, our so-called cold tumors. There is some data by Dr. Galsky and his team suggesting that, yeah, you may have less T-cell infiltrate, but this might be counteracted by less immunosuppression in the tumor microenvironment, in the stroma. So the question is still alive, but I think in this particular setting of visceral metastasis, post-platinum, I agree with Arlene and Dan, I would try to give either erdafitinib or an antibody drug conjugate. In that case, I would try to go for a high response rate compared to checkpoint inhibitor. The third trial will try to answer the question, but before we get the results, someone with liver mets post-platinum, I would try to go with erdafitinib or an antibody drug conjugate. Depending on the toxicity profile, can the patient, you know, take PO, swallow, you know, the other comorbidities this patient has. And in terms of the optimal sequence, we are still struggling. Obviously, you have a target, you think about going after it, like FGFR3, like we do in lung cancer. There were two small retrospective studies presented in previous meetings looking at patients with FGFR3 mutation. Do you give ERDA or erfotumab first? I do not think they answered the question because they're too small and they had caveats. So I think it comes down to, you know, individual preference, patient comorbidities, and familiarity of the provider with the agents. The last point I will make is regarding the challenge that you mentioned. It really depends on the context of the progression. If someone is getting avelumab maintenance after, you know, a response to stable disease to platinum chemo and has progression while on avelumab, I would be very hesitant to give single agent checkpoint inhibitor down the road. I would be open to immunotherapy-based clinical trials, but I would switch class to probably an antibody drug conjugate or erdafitinib as a next therapy. The same question came up in the chat room about rechallenge of with EV, enfortumab or sacituzumab, and this, we don't have any data as of yet about this question.
Well, that's really an interesting question. So Dan, here are a few of the slides that Arlene went through in her talk. I'm not going to go through these. Pretty impressive waterfall plot and efficacy and benefits. But again, I'm really curious about your personal clinical experience, Dan, and then we'll go to Arlene, of course, who did the research. But I'm curious how it's played out in your practice, Dan, in terms of some of these issues, particularly some of the ones we don't tend to see very often. You know, we're using these types of agents now in cholangio, but hyperphosphatemia, for example, the skin issues that come up, the eye issues. Dan, for practical purposes, what do you see in terms of efficacy and tolerability?
So we've had a couple of really excellent responses with erdafitinib in patients who are FGFR3 positive. This drug requires good monitoring. Patients do get fatigued. They sometimes do require a holiday from the drug because of either hyperphosphatemia or dose reduction or because of fatigue. That's been the predominant issue that I've had. I've not had any ocular issues. I've had one episode of hand-foot syndrome. So again, I think that with careful monitoring, with dose adjustments, the drug can be given safely and the patient can maintain an adequate or good quality of life. You do need to have an ocular exam done regularly at the beginning, if I remember correctly, on a monthly basis. But I've not had any episodes of central serous retinopathy requiring either dose reduction or discontinuation of drug.
So Arlene, I'm curious, of course, we're all curious about your thoughts about tolerability issues. I had some notes I jotted down during the talk. One was about diet and phosphorus management. What kinds of foods to try to avoid? Do you use binders? I'm curious, maybe comment on the nail changes that occur. And anything you want to add about ophthalmic issues? When we were talking, you talked about the Amsler grid. What's that?
Sure. So when we think of hyperphosphatemia, I typically recommend a low phosphorus diet when the patient starts therapy. And typically it's kind of like the renal diet. You want to avoid processed foods, you know, processed meats, avoid milk, cheeses, and meats, and a lot of sodas. So you have to check the sodas. A lot of them have phosphorus added to them and are very hard if someone's following a low phosphorus diet. The utility of erdafitinib, I've had very few patients requiring phosphorus binders, and I think it's because of the continuous dosing. If you keep in mind the trial, we actually increased the dose to achieve a target phosphorus level as a surrogate for inhibition of FGFR3. And what we see during the course of the trial is that phosphorus levels improve over time. And we believe that's due to homeostatic mechanisms in the kidney. kidney that evolve in the setting of continuous inhibition, which allow increased excretion of phosphorus. So if you're using an FGF inhibitor on an intermittent schedule, I do believe you will see higher phosphorus levels. There's other long-term effects if you're on treatment for several months. Like Dan mentioned, the hand-foot syndrome. It looks to me about after every 2 to 3 months, most patients will need a 2-week break to allow some healing to occur. We will see dryness or cracking of the nails or even infection of the nail bed. Good hand care is essential. Wearing protective equipment, rubber gloves if they're doing water activities, emollient creams to help prevent dryness, leather gloves if they're doing gardening or other activities that can cause trauma to the fingers, fingernails, or hands will help significantly. And as far as the central serous retinopathy, that occurs in about 25% of patients. It's felt to be an on-target effect of inhibitors of the MEK and MAP kinase pathways. We did monitor closely for this. Baseline ophthalmology exams and OCT testing look for any deposition along the retinal layer is important. We've done Amsler grid testing on treatment. And what an Amsler grid is, it looks like your basic mathematics graph paper. So it looks like a grid with a dot in the middle. Have them close one eye, hold it at arm's length from their eye, and then say if they note any wavy or blurred lines. Because one of the first clinical symptoms is that wavy or blurred line due to deposition along the retina. So rather than having a smooth contour, it'll be blurry or it will look a little bumpy, like the line kind of, you know, jags a little bit or has a curve to it. And if a patient does have blurred vision, my first question is, blink your eyes. They often have dry eyes and they can have mucus along the cornea. And if they blink and it goes away, it's probably mucus, and using eye drops or saline eye drops will help. But if they still have that blurred vision or wavy line, you hold the therapy, refer to ophthalmology for OCT testing and visual acuity testing. And then as soon as it resolves, which typically is within 2 to 4 weeks, patients can resume erdafitinib, typically at a dose level reduction. And the majority of patients are able to successfully resume treatment with erdafitinib with resolution of the visual symptoms.
So we're going to finish out this segment by hearing one of the cases that Arlene presented during her session. But again, another great question in the chat room is from Andrew, which is, what do you see on NGS or other similar assays, Petrus? And specifically asking about HER2. I feel like we're talking about HER2 every day, lung, you know, with trastuzumab deratoxin, lung, colon, gastric, and of course, breast. What about anti-HER strategies and urothelial bladder cancer, particularly TDXD, Petros, antibody drug conjugates?
Very, very interesting question, Neil. I agree. There is some very, very interesting data in ASCO 2019, I think, an antibody drug conjugate against HER2 with very high response rates. Now there is another trial ongoing combining nivolumab with another antibody drug conjugate, the DS8201A. We have not seen the data with that one yet, but I think overall, the strategy of anti-HER2 antibody drug conjugates look very promising. So if there's a trial available, I would definitely consider that. There is another trial just opened recently with tucatinib in advanced urothelial cancer with HER2 alterations. And there is also a trial with afatinib as well, with particular mutations or amplifications in HER2 and HER3. That Dr. O'Donnell has in the University of Chicago and other areas. So definitely good trial options for those patients. Outside of the clinical trial context, the only targeted approved therapy is erdafitinib, as we mentioned before, for FGFR2 or 3, activating mutation or fusion, not amplification. But definitely I'm very excited about the emerging data with anti-HER2 strategies in trials.
So Arlene, just a brief comment about this case. And Dan, I'm curious what your thoughts are in terms of how this case compares to your experience as a 65-year-old man with an FGFR3 mutation, starts out on 8 milligrams of erdafitinib and is increased to 9 milligrams, I think is interesting. Day 15, phosphorus level 5.4, He calls your office at that time saying intermittent blurry vision that comes and goes throughout the day in addition to dry eyes. As Arlene was just suggesting, his vision improves when he blinks. So artificial tears were used and he was able to continue on the 9 milligrams. He goes through cycle 4 and says he has blurred vision that does not improve with artificial tears. And Arlene, I guess he had what you just described, huh?
He did. He, you know, had an Amsler grid sitting on his refrigerator since we had some, we were using them in the office. You can pull them online. So download and print or buy math graph paper and put a dot in the middle. but yes, he noted wavy lines. He was doing the Amsler grid test at home as well.
So we're going to finish out. So let's talk though about checkpoint inhibitors. And again, a very common question from this audience was non-muscle invasive disease. Petrus, I thought this was very interesting and actually surprising to me that the majority of the audience has actually seen a patient that was referred to consider pembrolizumab for non-invasive disease. And in fact, half of the audience has actually treated at least one patient, which I thought was really interesting. Is that your sense that maybe is what's really happening, Petrus? I've kind of been waiting to see, it's been about 2 years now, whether or not this is going to actually come into practice. Do you think, does this reflect what's really going on?
I think it does, Neil. And to your point, the approval of pembrolizumab for BCG and responsive carcinoma in situ with or without papillary tumor came, I think it was January 2020. And this is a small proportion of patients. These are patients who have BCG and responsive disease with or without TA or T1. And their criteria to define adequate BCG therapy and what constitutes BCG unresponsive disease, and this has been published. So that's the first question here. Adequate BCG therapy, and does the patient have BCG unresponsive disease? If the answer is yes to both, then you think about what options the patient has, and ideally those patients should be offered radical surgery, radical cystectomy and pelvic lymph node dissection. If the patient is not fit enough because of frailty, other medical comorbidities, to undergo safely radical cystectomy and lymph node dissection, or despite adequate counseling, they still refuse it, then you have to think what to do with those patients. And I think in those situations when surgery is not an option, then I think about three options: intravesical chemotherapy, especially intravesical combination of gemcitabine and docetaxel. Intravesically has had some interesting data that from phase 2 trials. And now there are more trials looking at this intravesical combination chemotherapy being evaluated and may be used. Intravenous pembrolizumab is an option based on the FDA approval we talked about, or other clinical trials. And what we do at the University of Washington and the Child Cancer Care Alliance with the urologic oncologist and medical oncologist sees those patients, discuss the options of radical surgery, intravesical chemo, or intravenous pembro. And I think the numbers you quoted, Neil, are pretty comparable to what we see in clinical practice.
So Dan, to me, this is one of the most interesting issues in oncology because you have a potentially curative therapy in cystectomy and you're trying to use systemic therapy, which, you know, I guess at this point we're thinking about a 20% CR rate. We asked the audience, Dan, about a couple of scenarios and I'm curious how you would respond. We said, suppose you have a patient in their 70s who's otherwise healthy, just prefers not to get a cystectomy, wants to take a shot at pembrolizumab, who's BCG unresponsive. And the audience says, yeah, they do it. 80% of the audience would go ahead and do that. And even a few more people said they would do it for a patient who's elderly, not a candidate. That was, to me, that was the first thing I thought about when I saw these data. Dan, how are you kind of thinking this through in your practice? What would you do with a patient in the situation where the patient could go to surgery, but just doesn't want to?
I mean, I have to be as honest as I can be about what the consequences are and the possibility how things will change if the patient develops muscle invasive disease, which can be fatal. So it's a matter of preference. There are some patients who are young who don't want to have a cystectomy. They don't want to have a conduit or a pouch or have to catheterize. I mean, you can have a neobladder formed, and that certainly is an advantage in some patients. It's not always possible. But I think that you have to balance the quality of life versus the quantity of life. And there's some people who just simply don't want to have that issue. So The interesting thing I found is the majority of my patients that are referred have failed BCG, have failed GEM, have failed GEM plus a taxane. So they're more advanced than they were in that presentation and paper with pembrolizumab in non-muscle invasive disease.
So let's just finish out with a couple other issues related to checkpoint inhibitors. Petrus, this is a patient you treated, 86-year-old man with BCG unresponsive disease. Can you talk about how you managed him and what happened?
Absolutely. I'll try to be brief. So this patient actually met the criteria of adequate BCG therapy. And I put in the slide here exactly, got 6 induction doses and then had maintenance. So got 7 doses total of BCG within a certain amount of time. So met the definition of BCG unresponsive disease, which is actually published in literature. And the patient now has recurrent carcinoma in situ, has 2 tumors, TA. This patient, you know, ideally, as Dan mentioned before, we want to offer this patient radical surgery. If the patient is not fit enough for medical reasons or refuse despite counseling, we have these 3 options I put in the slide. Clinical trial, always a good option in our books. Intravesical chemo, intravenous pembrolizumab. And we talk about the potential side effects. If, for example, a patient has active autoimmune disease on steroids, that may steer us away from intravenous pembro and we go towards intravesical chemotherapy. If the patient has a really, really hard time with intravesical treatments and side effects from the bladder and has no autoimmune disease, you may try intravenous pembrolizumab. This particular patient who had a great discussion and we screened him for a clinical trial, it was not eligible and the patient opted to go for intravesical chemotherapy, but we still have intravenous pembro as an option.
So one final point, Petrus, in your talk, one of the things that happens in oncology is we have so, as Arlene was saying, there's so many checkpoint inhibitors, there's 6 or 7 out there, but people follow the data. You know, in lung cancer, locally advanced disease, pembro is used metastatic disease by far, but they did a trial in locally advanced and they did it with Durva and it worked. And that's what people use there. So people follow the data. And I just wanted you to comment on these data sets, looking at durvalumab and also with tremelimumab, sort of the anti-CTLA-4 strategy. Can you comment what was seen here, Petrus, and where you think it's heading?
Great question. I think that the short comment I have is for now, for the moment, the role of anti-CTLA-4 remains experimental, remains investigational in urothelial carcinoma. The Danuk trial actually came close. There was a trend towards benefit with durva-tremi versus chemotherapy, but this did not reach statistical significance in the intent to treat population. So chemotherapy still holds its position for many of those patients. Durva-tremi saw the benefit in an exploratory analysis in patients with PD-L1 high tumors, but this was an exploratory endpoint. It was not the primary endpoint. So durva-tremi did not make it. Again, it was interesting. The primary endpoint was overall survival, and you think about hazard ratios. There was a lot of discussion about the tail of the curve and whether if you pick a different point, like a 2-year overall survival landmark, whether this could potentially have changed the results. But for now, I think we're waiting for the CheckMate 901 trial, which is ipi/nivo versus chemotherapy. And this trial is still ongoing. They're going to look at patients fit for cisplatin or not fit for cisplatin, PD-L1 high and all comers. So until the CheckMate 901 comes, I think this anti-CTLA-4 remains a question for clinical trials in this disease.
So final comment from Dan on this strategy. We're hearing a lot of new data coming out and a bunch of other tumors on this strategy of anti-CTLA-4 plus checkpoint, Dan. And of course, one of the issues there is tolerability. You know, we know that you generally see more autoimmune toxicity with these combinations. Any thoughts about how these are tolerated, the kind of autoimmune problems you see, particularly in a bladder population, Dan, and whether you think in a few years, combined immunotherapy is going to be part of the standard?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to be a balancing act of the toxicities versus the overall benefit. I know that with ipi/nivo, with the lower dose of nivo that's being used now, certainly there is a lower rate of toxicities, but I've seen some cardiac toxicities with the combinations. And that's, I think, to me, the most concerning aspect of it. Fortunately, we have one case who's a CR right now, who was treated with a checkpoint plus an anti-CTLA-4. And she's CR and her heart's now back to normal with aggressive treatments with steroids as well as anti-TNF agents. So you've got to watch these patients carefully.